Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, a program designed to promote a positive work environment. Your hosts are Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. In this hour, you will be motivated to motivate, increase morale, productivity, loyalty, and reduce turnover. Learn how some companies get it while others don't. Now, here are your hosts, Roy and Max.
Welcome to Rideau's Real Recognition Radio, the show that's all about building relationships, inspiring greatness, and creating a workplace where people can thrive. I'm Roy Saunderson, along with my colleague and friend Max Brown, and we're from Rideau's Recognition Management Institute. How's it going there, Max?
I'm doing great and looking forward to another good show.
Absolutely. And you know, it's fascinating. I think you and I know that as we go into different workplaces and speak to different people, we see different types of individuals, and we can almost get a feel for the generosity or lack of as we connect with them. Have you found that too?
Well, for sure. And I think more importantly, we find that, you know, there are some that are just easier to be around, and particularly leaders who think bigger than themselves. And I think that's why it's so important to have a conversation like we're about to have today.
Absolutely. And our guest today is Adam Grant. Adam Grant is actually the youngest full professor and single highest rated teacher at Wharton Business School. He's been honored as one of Business Week's favorite professors and one of the world's top 40 business professors under 40. He's received numerous awards and extensive media coverage for his research, and he's consulted and presented for organizations including the likes of Google, the NFL, IBM, Merck, and the World Economic Forum, United Nations, and the U.S. Army and Navy. He's a former record-setting advertising director, a junior Olympic springboard diver. I can't believe this. All these people like to jump off springboards. I don't know.
That's right.
And he's even a professional magician. So I think we might have some sleight of hand, but maybe not today. He's also the author of the book Give and Take, a revolutionary approach to success. And I've been intrigued by his research with others like Dr. Francesca Gina on a little thanks and the difference that that can make. And that's what intrigued me to be able to see if we can get Adam on the show. Welcome to being on the show today, Adam.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here, Roy.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, maybe just for our listeners' benefit and who've not had a chance to read the book, can you share with them the premise that's behind the research that you've done on this give and take?
Sure. Well, I'm really interested in success, what makes people and groups and organizations productive and effective. And when I started doing research in the organizational psychology field, I came across three common answers, which were hard work, talent, and luck. And that made a lot of sense, right? We all know very successful people who put in a lot of time and energy, who have achieved mastery or expertise, and who've been in the right place at the right time.
Yes.
But what was missing for me from that picture was the role of our interactions in success. You know, we all live in a connected world, and I think our jobs are made up of other people, colleagues, customers, clients, stakeholders, lots of different groups. And what I decided to do in Give and Take was try to shed light on how our styles of interacting with others influence our success.
Well, that's great. Now, I know in the book you kind of highlight these different styles of social interaction as being givers, takers, and matchers. And you're indicating that these types actually impact the level of success we can achieve. Can you give us some evidence of some of your research findings that proves that?
Sure. So let me first define givers, takers, and matchers. So the takers are the people that many of us love to hate. They're the ones who are always trying to get as much as possible from others and never want to give anything back. And they tend to specialize in, you know, hogging the most interesting, visible tasks and leaving all the grunt work for everyone else, and yet somehow walking away with most of the credit.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to love them, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have the givers. And I'm not necessarily talking about philanthropists or volunteers, but rather people who enjoy helping others and frequently do it without any strings attached. Whether it's, you know, assisting your colleagues in solving problems, offering mentoring, giving advice, making introductions, or sharing knowledge. But I find that it's pretty rare for anybody to be a pure taker or a pure
mm-hmm.
giver. Most of us are in the middle of that spectrum of give and take as what I call matchers. And a matcher is somebody who tries to keep an even balance of giving and receiving, so it's quid pro quo. So, Max, if I were to do you a favor and I'm a matcher, I want an equal one back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Roy, if you were to do me a favor, I feel like I'm in debt until I've settled the score.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of evidence that, those three styles are universal across industries and across cultures, that we can find a mix of givers, takers, and matchers everywhere. And then, you know, we can certainly dig into some of the evidence about how those styles affect our success.
And what can you give kind of an everyday example that people might be able to relate to, or what they see in the workplace to more understand what they're looking for in these different types?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I think that in general, when you look at the takers, they tend to be the people, if you look at the evidence, who use I and me instead of us and we when talking about their successes. They also tend to be people who engage in patterns that I call kissing up, kicking down.
Okay.
Where, you know, if you're a taker, you're a really good faker when dealing with powerful people because, of course, you want the people who can really influence your career to think that you're a caring and generous person.
Mm-hmm.
But as you guys know, it's a lot of work to pretend to care in all of your interactions.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
Takers tend to let their guard down a little bit with peers and subordinates who see their true colors, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the givers are typically the people, you know, who are willing to share credit much more generously. They tend to help people even if they don't expect to be able to get something back from them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the matchers are basically the people who are sort of always keeping score, right? Trying to make these even trades, I'll do this for you if you do this for me.
Okay. Okay. Now, I'm curious, are there any kind of indications for like a breakdown by percentages? I mean, is there kind of a predominance of one type or another in society, or does that change by country, like North America versus Europe? Or is there any kind of spread that you can give on that?
It's a hard question to answer because, you know, a lot of the research on this, you know, says, look, you know, people fall somewhere, you know, in the middle of the spectrum most of the time. And so where do you draw the line from, you know, taking to matching to giving? The best studies that I've read that have tried to do this have suggested that on average in most cultures, what you get is about 40-50% of people who sort of operate as matchers most of the time at work.
Mm-hmm.
And then about an even split of the remaining in the giver and taker categories.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, of course, that's going to vary by organizational culture, by industry, by national culture, but that's where the averages seem to break down.
Okay. Okay.
Hmm.
And I'm curious. Do you find that we kind of flip flop between types, is this situational, or are we more or less the typology that we tend to display all the time?
Well, I'm going to do what all psychologists do when they're asked questions like this, which is say, both, and it depends.
Okay.
You know, so this is definitely situational, right? There, you know, we all have moments of taking and matching and giving. And, you know, I find that a lot of people, you know, when they're negotiating their salaries, they think more like takers. You know, if a competitor asks you to share knowledge, you might act more like a matcher and say, well, you know, I'll share, but you need to reciprocate. And, you know, when you're mentoring, you will often think more like a giver, and it would be really odd, you know, to say to your mentee, what have you done for me lately?
Uh-huh.
But, you know, what's interesting is despite the fact that we do fluctuate and flip-flop a little bit, most of us have a default style. You know, especially
okay.
if you look at the evidence in the work domain, you know, if you're a matcher, you tend to basically trade evenly with most of the people most of the time.
Uh-huh. And is this a very learned phenomena? Do you find have you seen this in the kind of familial, you know, training and upbringing and then getting into the workplace, is this still learned or is this still very innate?
Yeah, there's a ton of evidence for the learning effect. So if you look at the data, there's some research on charitable giving, which is, of course, a little bit different from the kind of giving that I've been talking about. But you know, I think that oftentimes what we see is about 30% of the variance in charitable donation rates are attributable to genetics. So, you know, genes seem to account for about 30% of the impulse to help others and try to contribute, and that leaves a lot of room for, you know, nurture as opposed to nature to take effect.
So, right.
Excuse me, we had a little sneeze there. If you look at the data then, you know, there's a ton of research on parenting styles. There's some evidence, for example, that parents who sort of rob their children of freedom by being really controlling often turn their children into takers who want to take freedom from other people.
Okay.
Which is interesting. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence that when we move into the workplace, we tend to look up the hierarchy and try to figure out, okay, you know, who are our role models and what has made them successful? And, you know, depending on what we see sort of at the top or among the people that we really respect the most, we often will emulate those styles.
Okay. Okay. Now, I'm curious. You know, it's the 75th anniversary of Superman right now. And you're saying that when you talk about charitable giving, you're saying that when you think about Superman, people are less likely to volunteer. Well, what did Superman have to do to merit this?
You know, I was deeply depressed when I read about that study because I grew up idolizing Superman. I collected all the comic books. I've seen all the shows and movies. So that being said, Nelson and Norton did this fascinating experiment where they asked people to list the features of Superman and then found that over the next 3 months they were less likely to volunteer. And it turns out that Superman is a little bit of an impossible standard. That when people think about, you know, being faster than a speeding bullet and more powerful than a locomotive and being able to fly, they say, well, I can never be that helpful, so why should I bother to try? Whereas, you know, interestingly, the twist was Nelson and Norton had another version of the study where they asked people to just list the characteristics of a superhero. And then, you know, instead of listing these superhuman attributes, they listed things like, you know, being really generous, being helpful. And they actually became more likely to volunteer because then they were able to connect themselves to those descriptions.
So in that sense, it was a lot more personalized rather than aggrandized, if you will, in the real superhero sense.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, fascinating insights, and we're certainly going to delve further into this so that we can help our listeners apply this great research that you've been able to do. It's time for us to take a short break. I'm Roy Saunderson along with Max Brown, and our guest today, Adam Grant. You're listening to Rideau's Real Recognition Radio on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll be right back.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. The next generation of employees is more sophisticated about recognition. They want to make a difference to their organizations, to their environment, and to their world. Rideau offers a full suite of recognition and reward solutions tailored to meet our clients' needs strategically, technologically, and globally. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio.
Get the news on our shows and other happenings by following us on Twitter. Find us at VoiceAmericaTRN or twitter.com/VoiceAmericaTRN.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about. Getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome
Welcome back to Rideau's Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and, of course, myself, Max Brown. And our guest today is Adam Grant, a Wharton business professor and author of Give and Take. Adam, I was intrigued in the book when you write that givers typically end up on the bottom and on the top, and that there's, you know, it's the in-between where other people lie. So being a giver can also have its negatives. Is that fair to say, or where do you land on this?
It is. So I looked at evidence from three very different worlds, looking at engineers and their productivity, medical students and their grades, and salespeople and their annual revenue. And in all three of those jobs, with those very different measures of success, the givers tended to have the worst performance. The engineers, for example, who did more favors than they got back, were the ones who ran out of time and energy to get their own work done and made more mistakes because they were too busy helping their colleagues to be careful. And, you know, I think we've all experienced this, right? We all know givers who just put other people first to a fault, and they end up really crashing and burning, either burning themselves out or letting takers take advantage of their time, energy, and resources.
And, you know, I think play out. How does this play out when it comes to being a giver? Then, why is this an attribute of a giver? Because I can see where you're saying that this happens. So maybe I don't want to be a giver then. But then you're saying, hold on, there's the other side too, right?
Yeah, it's very much a double-edged sword. So, you know, it can be incredibly dangerous, but also extremely powerful. Because if you look at those engineers and medical students and salespeople, it turns out that the givers are also overrepresented as the best performers, not only the worst performers. And so, you know, the most productive engineers are the ones who do more favors than they get back. The medical students with the best grades are the ones who enjoy helping others the most. And some colleagues and I found that among salespeople, those who cared most about their colleagues and customers often started out a little bit slower. You know, they weren't the ones who gave the really aggressive, pushy sales pitches. But over time, they asked more questions, they learned more about their customers' interests, and they ended up dramatically outperforming the takers and the matchers. And so, you know, I think that there's a pretty clear effect here, which is that good guys are more likely to finish last, but they're also more likely to finish first. And if you can understand what successful givers do, then perhaps you can learn to be an effective giver as opposed to one who becomes basically a doormat.
Well, and so you've got me thinking, what do the successful givers do differently? Because, you know, we're all thinking now, we don't want to be the crash and burn group. We'd really like to be on the successful side of this. So what do they do differently that we can learn from?
Well, one of the big differences between successful and failed givers is the willingness to ask for help. A lot of givers are reluctant to be on the receiving end of an exchange because they don't want to burden other people. You know, they're really worried about feeling, you know, incompetent or being vulnerable or looking like they're helpless. And yet, we all need help sometimes. And givers have created a tremendous amount of goodwill and trust in their networks. And if they're not willing to reach out, you know, occasionally, then they miss out on some really powerful opportunities. And, you know, I think that you can see this over and over and over again with successful givers, that they'll say, look, I'm going to put other people first much of the time, but when I really need help, I'm willing to ask and give other people who appreciate me the opportunity to give.
Wow, that was really powerful. I mean, who would have thought that, yeah, the ability to ask for help is one of the biggest differentiators?
Yeah, it wasn't my first instinct to look there, but there's just a series of studies that have backed that up. And you know, what's particularly interesting about that is a lot of givers confuse taking with receiving. You know, I think that taking is using somebody else and being unwilling to reciprocate, whereas receiving is saying, look, you know, I could really benefit from your support and assistance right now, and of course I'll be willing to pay it back and or forward when the opportunity presents itself.
Wow, really, really powerful. So it's just a different way of leading in your mind as well.
It is. And, you know, I think the other thing that comes across pretty clearly is that you're putting yourself at risk if you end up giving all the time to takers. And what I found among the successful givers that I studied and interviewed was they were actually a little bit flexible in their styles. So, you know, they would actually try to figure out, okay, you know, is this person who's seeking my help, you know, actually a giver, taker, or a matcher? And if the person is a taker, then I'm going to be more cautious and be more of a matcher in that relationship and say, I will help you if you are willing to either help me out or help other people that I care about. And, you know, I think that if you end up giving to takers all the time, it can be a recipe for disaster.
Wow. Okay. And this is instructive. So when you think about leaders who are essentially takers, how does this actually destroy or hurt the people around them, or does it?
Well, it definitely can. There's a powerful study by Chatterjee and Hambrick of over 100 computer companies where Wall Street analysts rated the CEOs on a taker scale. How selfish, egotistical, and narcissistic were they? And then they tracked the changes in performance of those companies over time, looking at return on assets and total shareholder returns. And the companies that were led by taker CEOs actually had more extreme and variable performance. The takers were really confident in their own bets, so they tended to swing for the fences.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes those bets really paid off, and other times they just destroyed their companies. And I think that, you know, the willingness of takers to take unnecessary risks is one thing that can cause a lot of damage. You know, I think the other big pattern that we see, of course, is that takers tend to create just extraordinary levels of stress for the people who work around and below them. Who sort of develop a state of paranoia, and in that case, it's not a delusion. Takers might actually be out to get you.
Yeah. Takers are out to get you. That's what I've always felt. And it's interesting, too, for me, that I often find that takers don't see themselves that way, but they actually preach maybe differently than they actually practice, which actually becomes a blind spot, which is exacerbated by arrogance.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's really common. And, you know, I think that there are accidental takers all around us. You know, it's a little bit like the movie The Sixth Sense. You know, they're takers and they don't even know it. And you could ask, well, why is that? And, you know, part of it, of course, is, you know, this desire that most people have to see themselves in a flattering and positive light.
Mm-hmm.
But what's amazing is there's some research led by Michael Ross showing that there's another explanation that may matter more, which is that we'll dive into the study really quickly. Think about two members of a married couple, let's say a husband and a wife, are in separate rooms.
Yes.
And psychologists do something really cruel, which is they ask them, the husband and the wife, independently to estimate of the total work that goes into your marriage, what percentage do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And then they add up the percentages from the husband and wife, and three out of every four couples add up to more than 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So there's somebody taking more than the other person, you know, sort of says, and not quite being aware that you might not be as much of a giver as you think, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at why this happens, most of it is actually driven, you know, not by this desire to paint a positive picture of yourself, but rather just by plain information discrepancy. You know more about your own contributions than you do about your spouse's because you were there when you walked the dog and took out the garbage and drove the kids to school. And by definition, you weren't present when your spouse did some of those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we find among a lot of takers is that, you know, they just have more access to their own contributions, their own acts of helping and generosity, and they don't see as many of other people's, and so they just don't know how they stack up.
That's a really interesting observation, actually. I really like that. So it's sometimes not even malicious or even malintent, as it is we're just biased towards ourselves, which is engendered in the fact that we were there when we contributed, but we didn't see others.
Yeah, I think it's so common. And, you know, one of the things that we need to do, of course, to try to correct that imbalance is make people aware of other people's contributions. You know, this plays out a lot if you're working in a team. Eugene Caruso and colleagues have done some really neat studies showing that if you get, let's say, five members of a work team to all do this estimation of what is their own contribution percentage-wise, and you add up those five people, they'll add up to over 140%. But if you can basically get them to make a list of everything their colleagues contributed first, they start to calibrate their own judgments, and they're a little bit more accurate in sort of, you know, estimating what they give relative to others.
Boy, what a great way of actually creating that awareness. I love that. That's a great idea and a great way of thinking about it. So when it comes to being a giver, bottom or top, the main thing is knowing that you need to ask for help. So at the bottom of this, essentially, would you still say that being a giver is a critical asset in today's economy?
Well, I think it can be. One of the reasons for that is if you look at the data here, Nathan Podzikoff and his colleagues have accumulated over 3,600 data points showing that the more frequently employees in a work group or a unit end up giving and helping, the greater that unit's profitability, customer satisfaction, employee retention, and also the lower that unit's costs tend to be. And, you know, givers add tremendous value to their teams, to their companies. You know, some of that is driven by knowledge sharing, which facilitates creativity and innovation. Some of that also comes from, you know, stepping up to coordinate and saying, you know, look, there's somebody who's absent from work today, or this process isn't functioning as effectively as it could. Let me sort of step in, even though it's not my job, and try to make it better. And, you know, we all depend on givers for those kinds of invisible contributions.
Boy, I really, really enjoy that. And I enjoyed a line from the book from Peter Audet, the managing director of Genesis Wealth Advisors, when you quoted him saying, "There's no doubt I've succeeded in business because I give to other people. It's my weapon of choice," he said. Does this mean we can learn to be a giver, or are we predisposed to one attribute or another and there's no changing?
Yeah, we can certainly all learn to change our styles, and that's true in all directions, right? If you're too much of a giver, you can learn to match and take more. You know, if you're too much of a taker, then you can do the opposite. And, you know, a lot of that comes from the small choices we make on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite ideas that I learned about doing research for the book was from Adam Rifkin, who is named Fortune's Best Networker. And Adam introduced me to this idea that he calls the five-minute favor. And he says, look, you should be willing to do anything for anybody that'll take you 5 minutes or less.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being, look, a lot of people think being a giver means you have to be Mother Teresa or Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's not sustainable for most of us. It's kind of like the Superman problem we talked about earlier. And Adam says, look, you know, what you should try to do if you want to be a little bit more of a giver is look for ways that you can add high value to other people's lives at a low personal cost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so for Adam, a lot of that is about making introductions. So he's in Silicon Valley, and he often meets people who are looking, you know, to find a co-founder for their startups with complementary skills. And, you know, he has an amazing network, and he usually can, in 2 or 3 minutes, find a few candidates and make a quick email introduction, and it's immensely valuable to those founders and hardly costs them anything at all.
Yep. Wow, it's a fantastic example, and I'm really enjoying this conversation. I know there's a lot more to talk about here, and so we're grateful you're still with us. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with our guest today, Adam Grant, Wharton professor and author of Give and Take. Join us in just a couple minutes as we come back on Rideau's Real Recognition Radio. This is Max Brown, Roy Saunderson, reminding you to keep it real. We'll be right back.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business. Relationships are the core of great businesses. Your employees are critical to the success of your business. Rideau helps you build positive relationships with your people. Rideau helps you inspire greatness in your people. We do it through the power of recognition and rewards. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. We're committed to our clients and our people. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio.
Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
Listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Rideau's Real Recognition Radio. I'm Roy Saunderson and Max Brown with our guest today, Adam Grant. And as you were just sharing there with Max, you know, about that good old 5 minutes or less, would you do something for somebody and how could you help them? I'm curious, are there different approaches to influencing people between givers and takers? What have you found?
Mm.
Yeah, there are. So one of the things that I've found is that takers tend to specialize in what you might call powerful communication. So, you know, if you're a taker, you feel like you want to be the smartest person in the room. You need to convey a lot of confidence and certainty and authority and dominance. So, you know, you tend to speak in these incredibly assertive tones. Whereas givers are much more likely to show, you know, sincere interest in what other people have to say and learning from those around them, and tend to do a little bit more powerless communication where they ask more questions, they seek advice from others, and they're willing to admit to some of their vulnerabilities and weaknesses, not only display their strengths. And what I love about this is there's some data now showing that powerless communication can actually be quite powerful for givers.
Wow.
So if you're working independently in some kind of solo job, then it's, you know, it might make sense to communicate in a more powerful way, because what you have to do is just convince other people that you're really competent, and the easiest way to do that is to talk assertively and authoritatively. But Allison Fregale at the University of North Carolina shows that if you're working interdependently, let's say you're collaborating in a team or you're working closely with clients and customers, they care at least as much about your concern for their interests as they do about whether you're competent. And these sort of soft-spoken signals that givers often send of speaking tentatively, asking advice, and so on, actually, you know, convey a pretty clear message that, you know, I'm willing to take an interest in your opinion and be open to changing my mind and basically collaborate as opposed to just stomping all over you.
Okay. Now, with the proliferation of social media today, have you noticed or seen how the social interaction features that we're talking about today, givers and takers, has that been impacted, or are the users of social media changing the way they use social media because of their styles?
Oh, it's a great question. I'd love to see more research on this, but my initial observation is that social media have made it a little bit easier for us to smoke out takers and recognize givers.
Okay.
So there's, as you guys know, in Chapter 2, Give and Take, I cover some evidence that you can spot a taker on Facebook just by looking at a profile photo.
Mm-hmm.
And the data on this is Buffardi and Campbell's research, actually suggests that the takers tend to have vainer, more self-glorifying pictures of themselves. Now, that doesn't mean they're more attractive than the rest of us, but you will find a greater gap between how they look in their typical picture and how hot they are in that profile photo.
Okay.
You know, if you're a taker, you want to put your best foot forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there, of course, also, I think, you know, if you look at LinkedIn, for example, there are many companies now, when somebody applies for a job and advances in the interview process, that will look for common connections and, you know, can get a little bit more of an authentic, spontaneous reference, as opposed to those old self-selected ones. So that ability to visualize other people's networks and find the overlaps between who you know and who they know, I think has made it a little bit easier for us to catch takers in the act, so to speak.
Right. So by going to LinkedIn and you're finding those common connections, you can often go behind the scenes rather than the elevated kind of comments that kind of appear just on front page.
That's right. And, you know, there, on the flip side, that can be an advantage for givers. You know, when,
yes,
when you seek out those references spontaneously, you know, the givers, are, of course, are the people who other people love to sing the praises of and say, you know, this person's incredibly generous, you can really trust this person, and so that can give givers a little bit of a leg up.
And you found a similar thing for the different typology around CEOs and the company annual reports. Can you elaborate on those telltale signs you saw there?
Oh, that was a lot of fun. This is the Chatterjee and Hambrick study that came up earlier. And after they got the Wall Street analysts to rate CEOs after interacting with them, they wanted to know, could you detect whether a CEO is a taker using information you could pick up without ever meeting that CEO? And they found three cues that distinguish the taker CEOs from the rest. The first one was actually the prominence of the CEO's photo in the company's annual report. So the taker CEOs tended to have larger pictures of themselves and also were more likely to be photographed alone, which sends a pretty clear signal, I am the most important person in this company, it's all about me.
Me, yeah.
And then, you know, there are two others. One was relative compensation. So in the computer industry, average CEO made about 2 to 2.5 times the annual income of the number two executive. And the average Taker CEO, compared to the next highest paid executive, made 7 times the annual income.
Wow.
So literally taking more.
No kidding. No
kidding. And then, you know, that was, I think, all supported by the press releases and interviews of the CEOs, where when talking about the company, they did use, if they were Takers, more I's and me's than us's and we's.
Now, is there any gender difference across givers and takers?
Well, the gender difference is an interesting question. I wrote about this a little bit in Chapter 7 of Give and Take. And the evidence that I've collected over the last decade suggests that overall there's no difference in the likelihood of being givers among men and women. So men and women are equally helpful. And at first I found this surprising because a lot of people stereotype women as the givers among
them. Exactly, yeah, more nurturing, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it actually tracks with research led by Alice Eagley at Northwestern, who has shown that overall men and women seem to do about the same amount of helping, but they do different kinds of helping behaviors.
Oh, okay.
So what you see is that women do more giving and helping in close relationships toward friends, family members, and you know their closest coworkers, whereas men tend to give more in emergency situations and in situations that involve strangers and public settings. I don't know if that's hero or macho or some of both.
Right.
But then the other gender difference that's really interesting is, well, what are the consequences of giving? And yeah, I think anybody who's read Lean In is familiar with this research by Madeline Heilman suggesting that, you know, when women give, we expect it, and so we're more likely to take it for granted. Whereas when a man gives, we're like, oh my God, he's so generous, he really deserves a lot of praise and rewards for it. And I think a lot of people look at those data and say, well, giving is just a better deal for men than women. And I say not so fast. Because Tim Judge and his colleagues have shown that if you are one of these doormat giver men, you know, who's just too nice, then you actually face 3 times greater annual salary penalty than doormat giver women do. And, you know, I think we could speculate about the reasons for this, but one explanation, it goes back to that idea of expectations that,
right,
you know, when women give and allow people to just walk all over them, you know, we say, well, at least they're helpful and caring and they're fulfilling, you know, our gender expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when men, you know, give in a way that allows other people to exploit them, they violate the most basic norms of masculinity, and we say, oh, that guy's a wimp.
Right. Well, listen, speaking about challenges and in those situations, I don't think I could have done what you did in teaching those senior military leaders right after getting your PhD on how to motivate their troops. That's what you had to teach them. What did you learn from that, and especially about being vulnerable?
Well, I learned that I was a really bad motivator. This actually ties back to the powerful and powerless communication topic. So basic idea was, I was in my mid-20s, and I was asked to teach these U.S. Air Force colonels who are more than twice my age on average about leadership and motivation. And after just finishing my doctorate, I felt like, you know, what I had to do, because these guys were so experienced and accomplished, I had to convince them of my credentials. So I came in with this very powerful communication. I talked about, you know, what I had studied, my degree, and, you know, sort of my wealth of experience, which was, of course, minimal. I got the feedback forms after the 4-hour session, and you know, I never forgot this one that said there was more quality information in the audience than on the podium.
Ooh.
And there was another colonel who said, I learned very little from this session, but I trust the instructor learned quite a bit.
Big.
Devastated, but I think at that point I realized that, you know, this was a group where what I needed to do was be more humble and modest and vulnerable.
Yes.
And, you know, make an authentic connection with them. So I changed my opening, and instead of listing all my credentials, I just opened by saying, look, I know what you guys are thinking right now. What can I possibly learn from a professor who's 12 years old? And there was this dead silence. And then one of the guys started laughing, and you know, the whole room sort of ended up exploding in a little bit of laughter. And then somebody piped up and said, no, there's no way the 12 is right. You got to be at least 13.
Mm-hmm.
It became sort of a running joke for the next few hours. And what was amazing is I delivered the same material.
Yeah.
And afterward, the feedback was completely different. You know, the colonel said things like, you know, it's really refreshing to have somebody young talk to us about how to motivate the millennial generation. And, you know, that, you know, although young in age, you know, he made up for it in knowledge of data and research.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, what that experience really taught me is there is often power in powerless communication, and that, you know, by basically calling out the elephant in the room, I was able to humanize myself and build some trust and sort of more natural rapport with this very tough and successful group of people.
And did that kind of stay with you? I mean, have you seen that as a beneficial strategy to use in other situations since then?
Well, yes and no. So after that experience, the following year I went into the MBA classroom and gave the same opening, and it completely fell flat. You know, they didn't want me to be humble and human. They wanted me to impress them. And, you
good
know,
old MBA students for you, right?
They were also in their 20s.
Yeah.
So I probably didn't look 12 to them. But, you know, in general, I have found that, you know, when I talk, you know, really candidly about what I'm bad at as well as what I'm good at, that, you know, I end up having a more sort of meaningful and heartfelt conversation with the people that I interact with.
Gotcha, gotcha. So lots of things to learn about the art of communication, more than just being pure transparent. It's also this styling of the communication depending on the audience, isn't it?
Very much so.
Yeah, wow. Fascinating insights, Adam, and we certainly enjoyed learning more and more of these principles that you've gained from your research. We'll look back with you for a quick break here, but for our listeners, come right on back for our final segment with our guest today, Adam Grant. For Rideau's Real Recognition Radio, I'm Roy Saunderson, along with Max Brown, reminding you to keep it real.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network. Relationships are the core of great businesses. Your employees are critical to the success of your business. Rideau helps you build positive relationships with your people. Rideau helps you inspire greatness in your people. We do it through the power of recognition and rewards. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. We're committed to our clients and our people. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Rideau's Real Recognition Radio. Let's continue the conversation with Adam Grant and get some final pieces on his book, Give and Take. Adam, I was intrigued and smiling a lot as you were speaking with Roy there about different CEOs and egos and how when you're more vulnerable, you found you've been able to connect better with people. And you know, a lot of people talk about this. Brené Brown talks about vulnerability and the ability to connect with people because of that vulnerability as well. Is there any other characteristics of givers that you find, as you called it in the book, otherish, as you call it? What did you discover around this that is so fascinating or so important?
Well, I should say that otherish is a word that probably never should have been invented. But, you know, it was the closest I could find to saying, look, you know, there's this way of mixing concern for others and your own goals.
Yeah.
It's not selfish like a taker, but is also not completely selfless, like, you know, those self-sacrificing, sort of overly generous givers that, you know, that we've met.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what the otherish givers basically do is, I think, intuitively understand what Bill Gates called at the World Economic Forum the two great forces of human nature. He said there's self-interest and caring for others, and that it's really a hybrid engine of the two that drives the economy, not one in isolation. So I think what successful givers do is, you know, they adopt this otherish mindset by saying, look, you know, I'm going to try to find ways of helping others that are either low cost to me, as we discussed with the 5-minute favor idea, or that might even be win-win and benefit other people and me. And, you know, that's, I think, really trying to do well and do good at the same time. But a lot of people look at that and they say, well, isn't that being a matcher? And, you know, the answer would be not at all, because a matcher is looking for something back from every person that he or she helps.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas an otherish giver is somebody who goes around basically trying to help other people with no expectation of reciprocity, but just being thoughtful about doing that in a way that doesn't compromise his or her own interests.
So it's a pay-it-forward mentality in terms of not expecting a reciprocity that way, but knowing that life is, you know, there's things that I'm going to try to achieve as well.
Yeah, that's right. To say, look, you know, I have my own ambitions, and I also would like to be able to make a difference in other people's lives, and I'm going to try to pursue those two goals simultaneously.
So let me ask you, because I've met a lot of people that say, hey, I want to make a difference in the world, I want to change the world. But when you unpeel the package behind that, it really is all just about them. And I'm not saying
everyone is that way, but there are some out there
like that, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think those are often takers who are good fakers. But not everybody is that way. So in Chapter 8 of Give and Take, I cover some of the data showing that there is such a thing as pure altruism. But it's also relatively rare. And most of the giving and helping that people do is driven by a combination of genuinely caring about the other person, but also saying, you know, I would really enjoy doing this, or it's consistent with my values and it helps me feel like I'm a good person. And, you know, I think that's another way of thinking about being otherish, right? Saying, look, you know, I'm going to give in ways that benefit the other person, but sort of allow me to express who I am. And, you know, I don't think we need to have pure altruism in order for somebody to count as a giver. And in fact, I find that the pure altruists are more prone to burnout and getting manipulated by takers because they don't really think at all about who and how and when they're going to help. And, you know, ironically, these otherish givers who say, yeah, I care about this person, but I care about me too, end up giving more because they're able to sustain and protect their energy and their resources.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, I'm just, my head is spinning as I think about all these things you're talking about. So are there some practical ways people can apply the principles behind the book in our everyday lives? Maybe what are a couple of these examples that we could think about today?
Well, you know, I think that you can think about what kind of giving do you find most enjoyable and most aligned with your expertise. You know, so some people, I mentioned Adam Rifkin earlier, love making introductions, and being a connector is their way of giving. You know, for others, it's about sharing knowledge or, you know, really recognizing other people who, you know, whose giving goes unnoticed, you know, maybe by writing a letter to somebody's boss after they've done something extraordinary. And, you know, I think what's really powerful is if you can find the form of giving that's meaningful to you and that really aligns with your skills, then what will happen over time is you can develop a reputation for giving in that way, and people are less likely to come to you for other kinds of requests. So,
if you're branding yourself, if you will, he
has such a great network that, you know, you don't want to bother him for other kinds of inquiries. And so he gets to focus on helping in this way that he really enjoys and, you know, kind of introduce people. And, and you know, I think that makes giving more efficient for him over time because every act of giving is an investment in expanding the network of people that he can help.
And, I mean, and ultimately it benefits him as well because people know he's the person to come to, and he often gets to see a lot of different deals and opportunities for himself as well then.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think he does, you know, his acts of giving with that intention in mind, but he certainly has benefited from this what goes around comes around kind of karma.
Adam, if you were to describe your higher purpose, what motivates you when it comes to giving or your purpose here?
Well, you know, I think that I was incredibly inspired by some professors who were brilliant examples of givers. And what I've tried to do is just pay a fraction of that forward. And, you know, I really find that I also love connecting people, and I really enjoy sharing knowledge. And those are probably, you know, my two favorite kinds of giving, you know, trying to help my students, you know, find jobs or connect with people that they would really enjoy working with. And then, you know, figuring out, okay, has there been some research or You know, is there some evidence that could help somebody look at this problem in a different way?
Right. Yeah, just to spark them and think of it differently, right?
There you go.
Love it. If there was a piece of advice you would give to people who are saying, "Gosh, I just don't know that I can change the way I've been," or, you know, "You just don't understand. This is my situation." How do you challenge someone who maybe feels like they're stuck in a way? They kind of like what they're hearing here, but don't know how to give where you're at or what you're suggesting here.
Well, I think the easiest place to start is just to spend a little bit more time going around and asking other people what they're working on, you know, what their challenges are, what kinds of problems they're facing. And, you know, I think what most people find, and, you know, this is true in a lot of research, and lots of the givers that I interviewed for the book also articulated different versions of this, is when you just go around basically with your antenna up trying to figure out what other people need, you stumble on a lot of ways that you can help that are just not that difficult for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that one way to try that out is through this exercise that I really love called the reciprocity ring.
Mm-hmm.
This was invented by Cheryl Baker at Humax Networks and Wayne Baker at the University of Michigan. And what you do is you gather a group of people, it might be 8 people, it might be 30, and you ask everybody to make a request. It can be anything you want or need, but it has to be something you can't get on your own. And then the rest of the group is invited to just help and, you know, try to use their knowledge and their networks to make that request happen. And, you know, as you hear these people talk about what they need, you know, you can identify a few ways that you can contribute. And, of course, it's a contribution in and of itself to organize one of these circles of people to help each other. So I think that's a great step for anybody who's stuck is, you know, just gather a group of people that you really like and invite them to help each other.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's a good way of doing it as well. I really enjoy how you give credit to the people that you've studied and learned and shared from as well, which is really powerful and I think very instructive for people today as well. Adam, for those who would like to get in touch or learn more about this book and the message you're sharing, do you have a URL or anything that people could go to?
Well, it's kind of you to ask. The URL is very cleverly named. It's giveandtake.com.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to the Give and Take website, you can find a self-assessment where you can fill out a survey and figure out, do you think most often like a giver, taker, or matcher? But all the listeners on right now know too much to do that accurately. So you know, the safer bet would be to take the 360 assessment where you can invite anybody you know to rate you anonymously, and then the site will aggregate the ratings and give you some data on where other people think you stand. And I always say try that one at your own risk. But on the Give and Take site, you can also find a bunch of articles and videos and blog entries and social media contact details for anybody who's interested.
Adam, we are grateful for your time. We're grateful that you would share with us, and we're grateful that you would give to us today.
I'm grateful that you gave me the opportunity to do this, and I really appreciate you guys asking such thoughtful questions.
Well, we're grateful. Thank you very much. And to all of our listeners, we are grateful for you as well. We love this journey. We love this message. We love sharing with people. And at Rideau, we believe in abundance. We say this with all of our guests. We always prepare each show as thoroughly as we can to help provide value and add value that is meaningful, timely, and useful for people that listen. Please visit us at Rideau.com, R-I-D-E-A-U.com. Tell us why you're here, why you listen, why you enjoy the show. We always try to recognize and appreciate those who do that. For more information about us, you can go there and find more information. We are so grateful for this opportunity to be here every single week. Until next time, this is Max Brown and Roy Saunderson reminding you to keep it real.
Thank you again for tuning in Real Recognition Radio. Please join Roy Saunderson and Max Brown again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for more motivational tips to help your employees perform better. We'll talk again next week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.